It was really the beginning of the tourism industry in Wyoming, which today is a, you know, huge, huge part of the state's economy.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. On this episode, we'll make some stops at some of the quirkiest mid-century roadside attractions along the Lincoln Highway. The Lincoln Highway, named in honor of the 16th president, was the first U.S. highway to run from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. Much of what was the Lincoln Highway in Wyoming is now Interstate 80, but parts of the original route are still separate. A Wyoming PBS documentary film that first aired in 2014 tells the story of the highway in Wyoming. Producer Tom Manning told Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden the Lincoln Highway holds an important place in Wyoming's history and in the history of the U.S. as a whole.
The Lincoln Highway was the first transcontinental highway across America. It was inaugurated in October of 1913, and it went from New York City to Times Square, New York City, to San Francisco, and it covered 3,300 miles. It went through 12 states, 4 time zones. It was quite the deal in 1913.
So give us a little bit of the history here. Where did the first idea to make a coast-to-coast highway come about?
Right. Well, a chap by the name of Carl Fisher owned a company called Prestolite, and he made acetylene headlights for early automobiles. He was also the founder of the Indianapolis 500 Raceway. So Carl Fisher was kind of a dreamer, and he had this idea in 1912 for what he called the Coast-to-Coast Rock Highway. He wanted to see a highway come across the United States. He thought the country was ready for it, but also he wanted to sell auto parts. So he pitched this idea to a bunch of auto executives in 1912, and among them, he must have had one heck of a pitch line, because Frank Seiberling, who was president of Goodyear Tires, immediately pledged $300,000. This is 1913 dollars. Henry Joy, who was the president of Packard Motor Company, pledged $150,000. It was Fisher's idea to have about $10 million to get this highway done across America. So in about 3 months' time, he had almost $5 million. And that was the genesis of it. And then Henry Joy came along to him and said, Coast-to-Coast Rock Highway, why not call it the Lincoln Highway in honor of Abraham Lincoln? So this was the first true memorial to Lincoln, because the Lincoln Monument in Washington, D.C. was still a dream. They hadn't been built yet.
Now, in the trailer for this film, you say that this road changed America forever. That's a kind of a bold statement. How did it do that?
It is a bold statement, but I think it's a true statement. I mean, this was the beginning of auto tourism. For the first time, people could go where they wanted to go on their own schedule, and actually get out of their own towns and drive to different cities. Heretofore, they had to take the train to do that. No, at first the road wasn't great. There were, you know, in Wyoming, they had terrible problems with mud in the spring, not just Wyoming, throughout the run of the Lincoln Highway. Eventually, as the road started to improve, people started traveling further and further. And so this was the whole beginning of auto tourism in America, and everything that we see along the roads today was because of the Lincoln Highway. The motel started with the Lincoln Highway. At first, people stayed with ranch families here in Wyoming in the very, very early days. These ranch families went, well, maybe we should build a few cabins and see what happens. And those got occupied quickly. And then that spun off to, well, let's make this a little bit bigger. So I think the epitome of this can be seen in Little America out towards Rock Springs. Little America started near Granger, Wyoming, because of the Lincoln Highway. And he started out small. It was Stephen Mack Covey who started it. And he started out small. He started out with a few cabins. He had a coffee shop. Soon he put in a cocktail lounge called the Palm Room. Then he put in some gas pumps. And it grew and grew and grew until he had a little empire. And so Motels were a result of the Lincoln Highway. Fast food is a result of the Lincoln Highway. Howard Johnson started with his 28 flavors of ice cream stands along the Lincoln Highway. White Castle Hamburger started because of the Lincoln Highway. So there's some good aspects to it, and there's also, you know, some, I don't know how people feel about fast food, but, you know, there's some negative aspects to it too. It kind of lent itself to the homogenization of American cities somewhat, but not certainly not in the early days. Part of the deal of the Lincoln Highway, unlike the interstate that replaced it, was that it went through the main streets of cities along the way. And that's how Cheyenne 16th Street got the name Lincoln Way, because it went right through the center of Cheyenne.
So we've talked about how this road changed sort of the way people travel and got people to see parts of the country that they might never have gotten to or certainly not by car before. What else? I mean, did it do other things for Wyoming? I could imagine that it could have helped bring extra business in from outside.
Absolutely. It was really the beginning of the tourism industry in Wyoming, which today is a, you know, huge, huge part of the state's economy. People basically, you know, after 1913 and through the 20s and the 30s, tourism really started to pick up in Wyoming, and all kinds of businesses, you know, that we mentioned earlier started to spring up. If you travel the Lincoln Highway between Laramie and Rawlins, that's the old US 30, it goes through Medicine Bow and all those little communities, Rock River along the way, you can still see remnants of the Lincoln Highway establishments along that road.
So with that overview in mind, let's hit the open road. Our guide is Aaron Dorbin, who worked as a buildings and landscape survey intern for the State Historic Preservation Office. We'll start on Wyoming's eastern border in Egbert. Chances are, if you've driven the stretch of I-80 or Old Highway 30 east of Cheyenne, you've seen it, that colossal white and turquoise roadside gem, the teepee. And maybe you've wondered who lives there, or simply why a teepee. Aaron has some answers.
I've seen a corn palace.
It is one of the best remaining examples of roadside architecture in Wyoming, yet people today know very little about its origins. To unveil the mystery of the teepee, I made it a point during my 3-month survey to ask everyone, what do you know about that teepee in Egbert? And one day, I took a chance and drove up to ask the owner himself.
Yeah, my name is Lawrence Anaya. I saw this teepee back in 1979. I used to work in Pines Bluff, the potato factory. And like everybody else, we, you know, used to say, I wonder what's in that teepee or what's, you know, what's it like and stuff. So, and then one day my girlfriend says, you know what, my boss said there's a teepee for sale. And the minute I saw it, I took advantage and bought it. Now I'm the proud owner of the teepee at 1091 County Road 154.
During the 10 years Anaya has owned the teepee, he's followed in the footsteps of the couple who previously owned it.
And they used to take pretty good care of it. You know, that man kept it pretty nice when he owned it. I'd like to do the same with it. So I've been working on it, and we got in here, we cleaned it all up, painted her, fixed the outside of it, planted trees around it.
Anaya has been an excellent steward of the teepee with the help of his nearest neighbor, Al Kane.
I met Uncle Al, how long has it been now, Uncle Al? 10 years or better?
Probably.
Uncle Al knew the previous owners of the teepee. Did he know anything about its past?
It was moved up here. It used to be on Old 30 on Lincoln Highway. I don't know if it really had a name.
As far as I know, it's supposed to, it was a bar back in 1960, 65, 70, as far as I know. Later on, I heard they turned it into a gift store.
I finally found some answers on a black and white postcard advertising a teepee-shaped souvenir shop and bar called The War Whoop in Egbert. The War Whoop. At least we've now got the name. But it is surprising that's all we know about a building that has been drawing the attention of travelers for more than half a century. Did Anaya ever think about opening it back up as a tourist shop? He says his sister thinks it may be a good idea.
Well, she told me how to make a tourist place out of it, a tourist trap out of it, and get people to come in and tour it and stuff like that. There's a lot of people come through tours and stuff, you know, and they ask me if they can take pictures. I'm sure, you know, go right ahead, you know. Very few of them that I brought inside, but I let them take all the photos they like outside.
But the best part of living in the teepee is that it's...
peaceful living.
Yes. No neighbors.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to move Uncle El about another mile, a little farther, I guess, pretty soon.
Anaya believes in preservation. He operates a classic car restoration shop across from the teepee. But he's also juggling health concerns with his desire to keep it in top-notch condition.
It might be greed or it might be appreciation that you have it and you don't really want to let it go, but... if I do sell it, I like maybe somebody in the family first choice.
The preservation of teepee structures like the War Whoop is controversial. Some preservationists ask, how do we honor the architectural history of American travel without promoting stereotypical attitudes toward Native Americans? But there's a hope that buildings like these can be used for education and at the same time still catch the eye of motorists along I-80 day after day.
Okay, let's hop back in the car and head to our next stop in nearby Cheyenne. Chain hotels and motels dominate highway exits. So with fewer travelers choosing rooms at small mid-century era motels, how are owners adapting their businesses? Aaron visited the Wyoming Motel to find out.
On a gorgeous late summer day, Victor Pisano is listening to oldies and fixing up his Jeep in the parking lot.
My name is Victor Pisano. I live here at the Wyoming Motel. I've been here maybe 20 years. I enjoy it here. I like the people here. I mean, it's like a little community by itself.
He explains how tenants' long-term residencies forged this community at the motel.
23 has been here for 5, 6 years. 14 has been here for about 8 years, so everybody stays. The owner is Dieter Coletti. He's very nice. He helps people.
Pisano has raised his 17-year-old daughter and the family pets here, too. It's a lot like any other neighborhood in Cheyenne. Even the interior layout of the former single-stay motel rooms have been altered to accommodate families. Pisano describes them as...
I'd say like adobe homes with a tile roof. When they made the rooms, they weren't all separate rooms. Now there's bedrooms and living room and your bathroom. It's more of apartment style.
I'm Dieter Coletti. As of yesterday, August 13th, I've owned a motel and the luxury diner for 31 years. Well, I used to work in Wheatland on a power plant, and Patty Bennett, she's a realtor, a friend of mine. I got laid off in Wheatland and I had nothing. And she said, I got a project for you. I said, hell, I don't know nothing about no motel. You know, she says, because it was in pretty bad shape. It was a bad shape. She says, you know, you like to work and I know you can do it. So I did it. Number one, first of all, I had to get rid of hundreds of cockroaches. I mean, it was infested. Patch was his name. You know, he was my first exterminator. And he was about half crazy because he wouldn't put on no mask or nothing.
From behind his office desk, Coletti directs me to a metal rack on the wall with 29 numbered slots, each holding a receipt for one of the motel's 29 units.
Most of my clientele is not credit card clientele. So we deal with payroll checks and cash. If I know you very good, personal check, if I know you for 100 years, that may be. Otherwise, no. In 31 years, I've been stuck with two checks, so I've been pretty fortunate. I look for the long-termers. A lot of my people are on disability or some kind of Social Security, and some of them are working folks, you know. Like last year, I had about a 99.4 occupancy rate.
The late 1980s saw an increase in the number of Americans taking up residence in the country's aging motel stock. Some are on a fixed income and can't afford more conventional housing options. Others are seeking more flexibility in their living arrangement. On a day like today, under the bright blue sky and white puffy clouds, the Wyoming Motel pops. The pale pink U-shaped structure with clean turquoise trim gleams. The motel's massive, brightly painted red, teal, and black Indian chief-shaped sign exclaims, "Wyoming Motel and Cafe" to passersby.
The chief, you know, the chief, that's my, you know, good luck charm. You know, he's my spirit in the sky. There used to be neon, you know, that would light up. But not the whole sign, the motel up there and stuff would light up. But boy, I tell you what, neon's expensive.
While Coletti is no longer looking to attract overnighting guests with the sign, it still draws hundreds of motorists and roadside architecture fans every year. And for those who stay longer, the chief welcomes them home.
Before we continue our road trip, let's take a little detour to learn more about Aaron's work along the highway. A few years ago, the Wyoming State Historic Preservation Office received a grant to survey buildings and landscapes along the I-80 corridor. That was Aaron's job. So I asked her and her boss from the State Historic Preservation Office, Beth King, why the interest in old mid-century buildings?
Well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, Micah. So there's always going to be someone who has no interest in a certain type of building or a certain style of architecture, and then there's going to be someone for whom all of their interest is channeled in that direction. And every building is important in its historic context, and that's really what survey work does. It takes an individual gas station, an individual diner, an individual motel, and it fleshes out the story so that you can see the greater context and meaning for that one building.
So nothing exists in isolation.
I think that is definitely true when you're talking about a major transportation corridor.
Yeah, I think that with structures from the 50s and 60s, a lot of the individuals that donated their time to take me around and kind of, you know, look at the landscape and identify these places for the survey, when I would point out something, they would just say, "Oh, that place? Oh, I didn't even think of it." Because to them, you know, this is just common everyday architecture. They grew up with it. People tend to sort of take it for granted. So it's important to conduct surveys like this because you're looking at places with kind of a new eye. You probably drive past it 100 times, but when you have 5 of these stations and, you know, your guide is able to connect, you know, say, "Oh, in the 1950s, I worked at this place and I went on my first date over here at the cafe and this truck stop, and, you know, they're telling a story of a place in a particular time. So I think there was, you know, great value. And once you got people starting to talk about these places that they kind of forgot that they lived next door to, they really, you know, came alive again too. And I got amazing stories, and I think it reminded them of the significance of place, you know, in their own personal history.
And Aaron Norbin, that's a good point to make, that you're not just pointing your camera and your microphone at empty or static structures. You're talking to people. This is a human story.
Absolutely. And I think that when I started doing surveys, you know, I tend to just, you know, take the photograph, and it was kind of outside of the context of the place and the lives of the people of that community. So, really trying to incorporate sort of a documentary approach, using place-based digital storytelling as a method to, you know, relate the story of the Lincoln Highway to travelers today. That was really my goal.
All right, let's get back on the Lincoln Highway. Our next stop is a motel in Rock Springs.
Springs Motel.
Norman and Irma Gillespie own the Springs Motel on the eastern end of Rock Springs.
We built it in 1968.
I'm Norman Gillespie. Well, I picked the name because it's Rock Springs.
We built it. This was a busy end of town because on the other end they didn't have very much. But then in the last about couple of years, they built the Hampton and all those big motels.
Motel time again.
The motel business along the Lincoln Highway has drastically changed since the 1960s, and travelers now require a different kind of accommodation. At the Springs, there are no flat-screen TVs or Wi-Fi, but the rooms are spotless. Return guest Donald Roberry describes his as...
It's cozy, it's nice, it's quiet. I mean, Nobody bothered
no
any?
Drunk, no nothing,
huh? Well, we get...
Well, they get drunk, but no.
No, we were all rowdy, yeah.
Companies used to stay here, and they still, and they're not working here as much as they used to, but when they come through, they always stop here. But there's just not that much work here. The oil field's gone up to the Dakotas, and there just isn't, you know. Oh, yeah, I get tourists. The last year was real good. This year was quite slow.
Everything went to hell on that highway there because you get your kids in the car and stop, fill up full of gas, it costs you $50. You go in the restaurant, it costs you another $50. And if they have to stop two or three times, they got a hell of an investment then, really.
I'm 86 and my husband's 86. And
well, I'll tell you, we're getting too old for this. And she isn't too well, so we had young girls helping us rent the rooms and everything, you know. Now, nobody wants to do that kind of work. Don't ask me why, because I don't know.
I liked the office. I did a lot of the office work and stuff, and waiting on the customers. I still do that.
We're just going to stay just for one night.
Okay. You want me to give you your receipt on that?
Yeah.
There you go.
Have a good day.
You're welcome. But with my age and stuff, I have a bookkeeper that does a lot of my books and stuff.
The couple were in the motel business prior to the Springs, running a former Lincoln Highway service station and motel.
Al's Motel.
But back then, they always had help from their family.
When my daughter was younger and still in school, she used to help with the cleaning, and she used to always say that she was going to run the office.
Now that their kids are grown, they have just one full-time employee. So after 40 years of operating and maintaining the Springs, what are their plans for their roadside icon?
No, we're going to sell it. We had a guy this spring come in and want to buy it, but I guess we changed his mind because we wasn't in no hurry.
You know, it's paid for and everything, and we can close the doors if we want to and open them when we want to.
I'd just like to walk away from it and turn it over to one of my kids. We have to pick somebody that it'll buy it that's got the money, because if you don't, they'll close it up, just like they're doing that one down there, because it's a hell of a job. And in this business, you got to do your own repairs and stuff, because you can't make it by hiring a guy down the street $30 an hour, you know.
I don't even know what town I'm in.
With fewer travelers on the road, Norman has unwittingly invited a new group of residents to the Springs.
He really likes these birds, and he feeds them all the time.
I started feeding them last winter because it was cold. And now they figure, hell, that guy could feed us when it's hot, too. I don't know how you get rid of them. They're like people, you know. If you feed them, they stay there.
That old number.
We're on the last leg of our road trip with Aaron, and our final stop is on the western side of the state in Evanston. Here we find Pete's Rock and Rye Club. At first glance, it looks like another shuttered roadside business. The exterior is overgrown, and the door is hard to find. By the look of things, you may wonder if this is the kind of place you'll need a secret handshake to enter.
There is one place along the Lincoln Highway in Evanston that everyone over a certain age knows, Pete's Rock and Rye Club. But patrons are pretty tight-lipped about the rowdy nights they've spent there. Luckily, I caught former patron Bill Schreiber and a buddy of his at the exact moment they drove up to reminisce. Who else pulled up? Owner and local legend, Stan Taggart. I witnessed their reunion.
Are you Stan?
Yeah.
You look like Stan. Hey. My name's Bill. And I used to come here 25, 28 years ago.
What are you doing in Evanston 25 years ago?
Working for Schlumberger.
Oh.
The blue truck. Nice. I was working for Schlumberger as an engineer. But I recognize you, so that's really pretty cool. I'm glad to see you're still running it.
Good
once in a while.
Schreiber shared with him some moments he remembered best.
When I was here a long time ago, you had a jukebox where you'd let us bring some of the 45s and actually stick them in there and play them and everything, and it was just a great place to hang out.
So just as Schreiber and I were about to get back on the road, Taggart offered...
You want to walk in? Do you?
We got time?
Did he want to walk in? Of course. Schreiber jumped at the opportunity.
Going in?
You want to relive it?
Oh, he wants to go.
Yeah.
We don't know when we're going to be back. He's going in. We're going in. I got memories flooding back. Holy cow. Oh, this is awesome. This is awesome. How long have you owned this place?
Since 68.
So is this digital or is this jukebox have records?
45s.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I remember was putting, you know, we bought you some records and you put some 45s in.
Yeah.
It was exciting to observe Schreiber's return to this one-of-a-kind tavern where he enjoyed some of the most memorable nights of his youth. Those days were during the oil boom of the 80s when he and others worked hard, long hours. Workers relied on places like Pete's to help them unwind.
So where would you sit?
You know, usually in a booth. Wherever there was a seat available, probably.
What else did he remember? I was still looking for one of those stories no one else was willing to reveal on record about their wild nights here.
Actually, I remember, so we were on call 24 hours a day, okay? So we weren't always working. There were different trucks, and so if people were in front of you, the odds of going out in the middle of the night were extremely small. So I remember being here with a friend of mine. Who comes in barging in the door is the manager, and he goes up to him. He's like, "You got a job in Casper, Wyoming. Get your butt in the car and get going." And of course, been drinking and partying. It's like, get the car and drive for 5 hours. So just, I have a lot of memories like that.
Stan Taggart revealed a bit more about his daily routine and 45-year run as owner of Pete's Rock and Rye Club.
I'll be 80 in February, and I ran 3.5 hours this morning and then went and got a load of wood.
Yeah, you look about 50, I reckon. You're well preserved, so I wouldn't change anything you're doing.
The bar is now open exclusively on Fridays and Saturdays.
6 p.m. till they give up.
As Bill and Brian left, they vowed to come back the next Friday or Saturday they were in town. If you find yourself at Pete's Rock and Rye Club, be ready to discuss your current reading list and last night's episode of The Colbert Report. Taggart is a well-read, quick-witted gentleman and conversationalist. Pushing 80, he and the Rock and Rye show no signs of slowing down. Before I left, I asked him what was on his agenda for the rest of the day.
Unloading the wood and going to the post office and the library and the grocery store. And then I'm going to run again for a half hour because something might be gaining on me. Yeah, running down a dream.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Dorbin.
Although some of the old roadside attractions along the Lincoln Highway are still alive and well, there is also the occasional ghost town. Ghost towns may conjure images of old shootouts, tumbleweed rolling down dusty streets. But there are also more modern ghost towns with less romantic stories. Laramie photographer Doc Thissen documented some of the towns along the Lincoln Highway bypassed by Interstate 80. He talks about recapturing the America that was lost in his photo series.
I've gone back in to the buildings and these places that have been abandoned to attempt to bring life back to them by putting artificial light into them.
Themes of abandonment and loss carry through into his new project. Thissen is now photographing forgotten towns along Wyoming's old Lincoln Highway.
It was originally America's Main Street. It joined the country. Populations small and big all depended on highways like the Lincoln Highway, which was the first one to cross the country completely. The whole thing about these highways was it was connecting people and places.
But starting in the 1950s, traffic moved to the new, faster Interstate 80. And while it closely follows much of the original Lincoln Highway, it bypasses many of the towns America's Main Street once passed through.
We just want to get from point A to point B. We don't care about the stuff in between.
To photograph the stuff in between, little towns like Bosler or Table Rock, Thissen shoots from a platform on top of his truck and mounts the camera even higher on a tripod, so the view is from as high as 12 feet off the ground. And for the viewer, that means
seeing things from a slightly different perspective than just straight eye level.
New perspectives are a recurring theme in Thissen's work. He doesn't let documentary photography limit his ability to offer a fresh view of the familiar or even the forgotten.
We're losing the connectedness of the country. We're losing the connection between people to people. I guess that's my point to this whole thing, is I'm trying to recapture the America that was lost.
And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. We'll be back with another episode on the third Tuesday of the month. In the meantime, if you have a moment to leave a rating or a review on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it because that helps other people discover the show. Jamie Hampton produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. And I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.